Once upon a time, in a magical land called Packet Pushers, where the unicorns ran free and Ethernet frames were plentiful, there was a kingdom called Healthy Paranoia. It was ruled by good King Ivan with his beautiful and much, much younger daughter, Princess Y. On an ill-fated day, a dark cloud descended upon the land, a cloud called Vamwari. It was an evil time, and the land suffered under a heavy burden called V-Tax. But then one day, the noble Prince Tony of Hipster arrived from a mythical land of vegan brunches called Portland. He saved the kingdom with his virtuous companion, Sir Ethan of CCIE, covering the noxious cloud with an enchanted cardigan made of fair trade wool, and the land was restored. The commitment ceremony for the prince and the princess was celebrated by the people. They cried huzzah, and the jester Greg of Snark danced many jigs. Joining this merry band was Taylor Banks, cloud security expert. Introduce yourself, Taylor, and take a bow.
Oh, that's a bit hard to follow, but thanks very much for having me.
Outstanding, Michelle. Outstanding.
Wait. Did I just get married?
No. It's a commitment ceremony.
Yeah. Near enough. Does it matter?
He didn't know that when he agreed to the podcast.
Just say yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Today it's all about the cloud. It's about cloud security. And with us we have our merry band of packet pushers. We have Ivan Pepelnik, we have Tony Burke, we have Greg Farrow, and we have joining us Taylor Banks. I thought we'd start with the wonderful NIST definition of what is a cloud. Cloud computing is a model for enabling ubiquitous, convenient, on-demand network access to a shared pool of configurable computing resources that can be rapidly provisioned and released with minimal management effort or service provider interaction. There are so many jokes there.
All right, I'm gonna drop an impression on you. I'll see if you can figure out who this is. It's just servers and networks and software. That's all it is. It's just servers and networks and software. What is this? The cloud? There's no water vapor there. It's servers and networks and software.
Oracle? Larry?
That's Larry Ellison.
Larry Ellison, because he thought of the cloud first, but too early, and everybody else has now scumped him at the end.
Yeah. There was a great video. He was at some conference, just sitting down, and someone asked him about the cloud, and he went off. He did a pretty epic rant. And then, like 2 years later, he was introducing Oracle's cloud platform, and being very calm about it.
Well, isn't that what every vendor did? It's like, what's this? The cloud? No. And then a week later, some of them turn around and we're all about the cloud.
Yeah, and that happens with SDN now.
Yeah, same thing, yeah. Agreed. Yeah.
All networking equipment is cloud and SDN enabled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even though nobody knows what either of those are.
Right. It says a lot to me that NIST's definition is the most succinct but accurate version of the definition of cloud, you know? Mm. It's not very succinct, so...
It tells you nothing, right?
That's okay. Never let knowledge get in the way of a solution. That's my trademark motto. So,
I thought it depends.
It's not a bad definition for all instances of cloud computing, because we could sit down and have an argument about PaaS, AS, SaaS, you know, and all the different types of cloud, and at the end of the day, who gives a rat's? And the answer is it's hosting your gaming, your game, your business, your intellectual property in somebody else's data center.
Wait, am I the only one that noticed that all those include the word ass in them?
Yeah, no.
That's why I took this job.
To get some ass.
I'm swimming in ass right now.
I've always said I was an ass man, so.
Okay. We're going to have that disclaimer on this podcast. We'll try to avoid that.
I think so. I've been using the definition of the cloud is a cloud of shit I don't care about. Pardon the French there. We can bleep that out. But it's It's shit I don't care about. It's I used to care about operating systems, and I used to care about kernel tweaking, and I used to care about putting the CD in the CD-ROM drive and installing Linux or installing whatever, installing Microsoft. Sorry, I just threw up a little bit in my mouth there. But and now it's, you know, with some sort of automation, I don't really care about that anymore. I mean, operating systems especially, they're not really that interesting anymore. They used to be really fascinating. There used to be huge differentiation between them. But now I don't really care.
I actually agree with you. It's just a tool to get you to deployment of applications. It's not really that. Yeah, I used to be so in love with the OS and learning the ins and outs of it. And now it's just not that important anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really any differentiation. If you go into an OS, like, you know, you install Ubuntu or and you tweak it, or you use, you know, install Gentoo versus Ubuntu, there's not really that much difference in performance anymore, or at least not anything that was that'd be worth spending your time on. And so we've gotten to the point where it just, you know, it's kind of like a car with a stick shift. We, you know, in the U.S., we don't really have those anymore. We used to care about what gear you're in. Now when you drive an automatic transmission, you don't care about it anymore. So
yeah, it's kind of the ultimate abstraction layer in a sense. It's the cloud is the place where you put all of the things that you don't want to have to worry about all the details about anymore.
Yeah, and stuff that doesn't really matter. I mean, when you're driving on the road, you can know what gear you're in, or you don't know what gear you're in. I mean, for most people, unless you're doing Formula One racing, you don't care what gear you're in. The car can decide for you, and the automatic transmission does it for you, and it's fine. So there's a whole lot of stuff that we used to tweak, and we used to set up, and we used to manually do, and now it's all automated, and that's great because now we can care about other stuff.
Yeah, we can care about the important stuff, like, you know, what Neil Gershenfeld talks about, you know, it being just a tool to get you to the place of actually building other stuff. I mean, we don't want to be obsessed and overly focused on this thing, this tool. That's all it is. It's just one flavor of tool that gets us to, you know, create services.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, there's a certain amount of hacking and tweaking and so forth that I used to love to do, and to a certain that's still true, but I mean, I think a good example is a cell phone. There's some, you know, with Android, you can root a phone, and you can do it with iOS too, and there's all these ROMs you can get and so forth. And I just don't give a shit anymore. I just want a phone. I want a phone to do email and look up stuff, and I've got TripIt on it so I know where I am. I just want something that works. I don't want a hobby.
And so you think that's one of the benefits of a cloud?
Yeah, this is probably a little more specific than actual cloud, but some sort of automated environment where I can just deploy the services and stuff that I need instead of going in and manually installing every operating system and then manually installing all of the, you know, Apache, MySQL, all that stuff. It just had, you know, one click and it having it do it for me. And whereas 10 years ago, if something did it all for me, feel less of a sissy, I would feel.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think the world's kind of moved on. I think the first instantiation of the cloud was the public cloud, where everything was abstracted away. And I think the real future of the cloud is in the private cloud. So if you figure today that the public cloud's worth $10 billion and they reckon that in a year's time it'll be worth $20 billion, that's still less than one-tenth of the total investment in private IT going on today. And so if you look at the price of data centers in people's private data centers today, they're already spending well in excess of $150 billion, rising to $200 billion. And the concept of the public cloud is short-term at best. So public cloud will be there mainly to enable business models that didn't exist 2 years ago. So, for example, Pinterest couldn't have existed 2 years ago because there's no way that business would ever get funded by a bank, right? If Pinterest rocked up to a bank and said, we need $50 million to build a data center and fill it with 2,000 servers so just in case we need enough load, the bank had given them the finger and tell them to head right out that door there. That business wouldn't have existed without Amazon, right? Without public cloud that allowed them to scale without actually any consideration. And Amazon exists because they can glom multiple business units together and they can actually scale the intent of those data centers. But in the long term, another business that does the same thing is Netflix, for example. Netflix wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the fact that they could use somebody else's data center. In other words, they only make revenue when...
Not true, Greg.
Yeah,
Netflix had their own data center.
Yeah, but they can't burst. They burst into the cloud for the load.
No. They could use their own data center. It's cheaper to use the cloud, but they could exist with their own data center. They did.
They couldn't get any money from the bank because they don't have a certain business model. They're not guaranteed to get money next year or the year after because they live at the whim of a 2-year funding cycle for licensing of content. And if the movie people take away their rights to distribute content, Netflix is out of business. They don't own the fundamental product that they sell.
Well, I think this is a really interesting conversation, and what I'm noticing is that there are so many companies, medium-sized companies, that are just now starting to have the conversation about, what do we want a cloud? And meanwhile, everything else, the world around, has already gone 1,000 miles ahead. And as a result, I mean, the reason why I wanted to have this show was to sort of demystify a lot of security issues around that, because people get stuck. I think the cloud, like what Tony was saying, it creates new possibilities for a way of looking at your IT infrastructure. You know, it gets you out of this day-to-day reactive, like just doing the business, the nitty-gritty business of, being a factory worker, and gets you to a higher level of moving beyond that and creating more services and more possibilities for your organization. But I see organizations getting stuck in the deployment, especially the security part of the deployment. They get stuck within arguing about, you know, how you set it up securely, how you set it up efficiently, and it's frightening to them. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to get everybody together. A lot of you have much more experience in virtualization than I do, but I think it's an important conversation to have.
Well, I think this is interestingly what Greg was saying about kind of the evolution of cloud towards private cloud. I think that's really kind of where the metaphor of the automatic transmission begins to fall apart. I think that's a great metaphor when you're looking at public cloud, when you're looking at software as a service, and to a lesser degree, platform as a service. But as we start to see more and more private cloud, we're really seeing a lot of infrastructure as a service. And I think this is one of the areas where there's a lot of confusion around cloud security, is I think initially people kind of they assume or infer that a lot of the responsibility for cloud security is in the hands of the cloud provider. But when you really, you know, get down to the level of infrastructure as a service, I think it's a mistake for organizations to assume that buck has passed and that they don't still have the responsibility for securing their data. And I think that's why there's a lot of confusion. What does cloud security mean? Well, it's very different depending on what your cloud looks like, what you're building, what you're using it for, and what you're putting there.
Well, right. Okay, let's start with a private cloud. For example, you know, a lot of organizations now are getting UCS, Cisco UCS, or they're getting, you know, HP solution or Dell solution, and they're setting up their private cloud. And a lot of people, their goal, like I asked our cloud implementation people, where I'm working now, and they said the goal was 100% virtualization. Now, that may
That's
or may not...
cloud. That's virtualization.
Well, but they're talking about a private cloud. Wait. They're saying they're calling it a private cloud because they're thinking of a model, and this I thought was a great... I read somebody who called it a data center within a data center. And a way, that's the way they want to approach it, because then they want to bridge it and create a hybrid cloud. You're saying that's not a cloud. That's not fair to be called a cloud.
Michelle, the fundamental property of a cloud is self-service.
Well, they want to go in that direction. They want to create self-service.
So will the application teams deploy their own servers?
That has been discussed. That's where they want to go.
Well, if that's what they want to do, if they want to push all the responsibility to the application teams or to departments or what have you, that's cloud. If they still want to manage the firewalls and want to manage the operating system, want to manage who knows what else, that's not cloud, that's virtualization.
Well, see, that's the other problem. Nobody can even come up with – one of the things I've noticed about virtualization or cloud is that nobody can decide whose responsibility it is to manage the networking side and the security side. The traditional silos don't work anymore. With you know, hard metal with iron, you have, you know, it's very clear, oh, the server, it's a thing, and that belongs to the server team. The firewall is this thing that belongs to the network security group. Nobody can figure out now, when it's all in this virtual thing, nobody can figure out, because that means collaboration, it means talking to each other, it means crossing like silos, organizational silos, and that is the part that scares me the most.
Well, yeah, the world used to make sense. We used to have servers and we used to have networks, and never the twain shall meet except at that one point. And then some idiot went put a vSwitch instead of a server.
Here, here.
Yeah, but those separations were arbitrary. They were, the networking skill set was differentiated enough from server, which was differentiated enough from storage, which was differentiated enough from application space, that each one of those grew up as a discipline that focused on those. I like Ivan's point there, is that private clouds is not virtualization. Virtualization is taking your existing physical estate and stacking them 20 servers to one physical element through the use of some hypervisor. Pick your favorite flavor. I do not care. I agree completely that the private cloud is about an automation system like OpenStack or CloudStack or VMware's vCloud, which presents a web browser so that the user can go in and say, I need, and user in this case is normally a developer or, you know, the application owner who can say, right, I need 10 Windows servers of standard build, click here, and it says, what memory do you want, how much storage do you need for those, and here we go, click, and they get deployed, and they appear in the Active Directory. The volumes are allocated, the images are mounted from checked in from a standard location with the standard build, and all the licensing and all that. And then out the back of it comes an invoice for server, space, blah, 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 blah. That's a private cloud. I absolutely agree with that definition. And that, in fact, is what I've been trying to build for the last 6 months, is working through how to build one of those stacks. And it's hellishly good fun.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. I don't know if I would agree that that the cloud requires entirely self-service, but certainly more than virtualization. I would think, or what do you think of the definition of a little looser definition of the cloud is anything that is highly, highly automated. So tasks and procedures that we used to do by hand, one by one, in maintenance windows, and it would take, you know, 3 weeks to deploy a server. And now we can do it in 30 seconds. So going from 3 weeks to 30 seconds.
And the physical part's been moved into a different timeline.
Right. So not necessarily self-service, but...
sorry, Tony, that's the crucial point. Who's responsible? With virtualization, you have the silos, and every silo is responsible for whatever it is they're doing.
Right.
With cloud, you provide the resources, and then people can deploy whatever they wish to deploy, and they are responsible.
Okay, yes. Well, so what does that mean for security then? I mean, that's
exactly
this is where it gets really fuzzy, and this is what I'm noticing.
It's not fuzzy.
Okay, no, it may not seem fuzzy to you, Ivan, but it's definitely fuzzy when you move into organizations. What I'm seeing is, everybody wants to sort of like run away from it, you know.
It's not my problem. I know that. I've seen that. Yeah.
I think part of the problem here is that with the automation, there is some assumption that the magical unicorn of security runs through and automatically secures all of these component pieces. And I think that's where people are falling down a bit. Is they push the button, they deploy a server, they allocate the volumes, it's connected to Active Directory. And they kind of forget the responsibility for securing the data that lives within these instances, that lives within these volumes. And I think that's, even though I agree that self-service is key here, I'm not seeing as much attention being given to the self-service of the security components or the security surfaces, whether it's public or private.
Well, Taylor, isn't it overwhelming? I mean, that's what I'm finding. You have all – 'cause you've got a couple of options here. You know, that you've got the option of the introspection firewall, which is per NIC. You've got the edge firewall, or maybe, you know, with VShield Edge, or then you've got the option of just going out completely and hitting a physical security device. And when you sit down, you could have arguments and discussions that go on ad nauseum into what the right way to do this is. We're having those discussions now, and it just doesn't seem to get easy.
Without a doubt. I agree wholeheartedly, and I think that, in a sense, that kind of exacerbates the problem, right? The more complex security is, despite the simplicity involved in server deployment and cloud deployment, the more people are likely to ignore it, right? The more people are shying away from it, or instead of really looking at the various solutions, they're basically kind of throwing a dart at the wall and choosing whichever solution is the easiest to plug in.
Okay, well, so in your experience, everybody who's touched virtualization and cloud, how many people are actually deploying the zone-based solutions, the introspection-based solutions, in conjunction with traditional security appliances? I mean, how many people are actually using those? Because I find them incredibly complex.
Yeah, do you have a Sound of Crickets clip that you can play?
So the answer is, in some organizations, what they have today is an internal network policy which says there's three internal security zones in a sort of a ladder security framework. You have this is the production, this is the non-production, and this is where dev sits. So there's normally, in a financial institution at its most extreme, there's like corporate, there's like the production network where servers all live, then there's a non-production network which is pre-play or, pre-run stuff, and then there's a dev network. There's not normally, and what they're building today is private clouds in each of those zones. Well, that's the way the institutions I've worked. They're saying, right, VMware isn't secure to transition between multiple zones of security, which is true. We'll probably talk about that in a minute. In other words, hypervisor security is so poor that I can't have dev and production servers in the same piece of cloud because I can't separate them readily. I can't isolate them at a policy or a procedural level. And so what's happening mostly today is people are actually building a mini cloud in each of those zones, which is pretty pointless, but that's what people are doing to meet the security policies.
Well, that's the PCI DSS requirement. I mean, in PCI DSS 2.0, if you build a mixed mode cloud, then you're supposed to build in, it has to be in PCI scope. So if you have, in other words, if you have non-PCI and PCI data, it has to all be built to PCI standards. I mean, Taylor, you're more familiar with actual attacks on hypervisors. I mean, what's your experience? Is it just fantasy or is it reality?
Well, I wouldn't say that the hypervisor security is so poor, for instance, that we have to provide the separation. But I guess the bottom line is I do still agree with what Greg said in that the risk exists and therefore it can't be ignored, and we can't say, hey, well, the hypervisors aren't being actively exploited and therefore we're going to ignore the possibility that if somebody does exploit the hypervisor, they own all of the keys to the kingdom. So I tend to shy towards the more formal, complete separation, physical separation, zone separation. So in general, I have to say, even though there have been exploits against the hypervisors, I think realistically, active exploitation of them is relatively limited. We don't see a lot of exploits in the wild. We don't see a lot of people who are having their environments or their corporations compromised because of these hypervisor vulnerabilities.
But you're saying you'd still err on the side of caution. Is that what you're saying?
I tend to always do so, and I'm a bit of a security purist in that regard. How necessary is that? I don't know. I see a lot of organizations who, whether for cost or complexity reasons, don't do that. And I think they are more willing to use the same hypervisor to provide public and private facing infrastructure. I don't agree with that, but it's kind of the same as, physical versus logical separation in any access control context.
Well, I mean, I'm a little concerned myself because, we had Blue Pill in 2006 and we had Cloudburst. Blue Pill was the Microsoft hypervisor rootkit that, the attack, and nobody could really recreate it, but it was more theoretical than actual proof of concept from what I understand. Is that correct, Taylor?
Yes.
I know she got a lot of, the woman who did it got a lot of crap about that. And then there's – yeah, and then there was Cloudburst, which was – I think they actually did have a proof of concept. They had a working exploit for that, but it was quickly addressed in 2009. But, yeah, to me, in my mind, because VMware and a lot of other vendors are coming out and saying, no, 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 you can do mixed mode. No, 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 it's – you can do – it's it's okay. You can do that. We here, we're going to prove it. But do we trust the vendors?
Well, this reminds me of about like 10, 15 years ago when we started doing VLANs on switches. You know, is VLAN secure? Is VLAN good enough for security separation? And I think, I don't know, for the most part, it seems to be that the security – I posted in our doc here. I posted an article someone wrote in the year 2000 about switch security and talking about how you should use different. You should not use VLANs, and you know, I don't think we've gotten nearly to that point today. I think we've you can probably make a switch. You know, if it's an exploitable switch, you can probably hop a VLAN, but. I mean, to me, it seems like most of the exploits today are application level. So they're, you know, doing the SQL injection or cross-site scripting or something.
I mean, and I think additionally, you know, the problems that we see with the virtualization products or the products that underlie our cloud, frankly, the exploits are mostly against the management interfaces. It's because, you know, a web interface was implemented improperly, or there's an authentication failure. You know, in general, we don't really see people having the opportunity to take advantage of these hypervisor exploits. It doesn't mean they don't exist, or the possibility for them to exist isn't there. But I think, you know, realistically, like you said, you know, there's the networks, the compromises are happening because of application level exploits, because of management exploits, not because of insecure hypervisors.
That's simpler.
Yeah. Is it just because they're too lazy? I mean, let's face it. I mean, getting a hypervisor exploit
Michelle,
is going to be harder.
To be realistic, and Taylor is exactly right. Hypervisors probably have vulnerabilities, but those things are hard to find and hard to exploit.
Right.
And on top of that, everyone has some homebrew scripts. How secure are those?
That's right. And it's always a matter of low-hanging fruit, right? So if I need to compromise your network, even from the perspective of doing penetration testing, and I've got the option of trying to reverse engineer a 32-megabyte hypervisor, you know, that's doing pretty complicated stuff and is reasonably well reviewed versus, you know, a social engineering attack or password guessing against an exposed management interface. Hey, the low hanging fruit is we're going to bang on that exposed management interface and we're going to ignore probably any possibility of trying to get to the hypervisor.
It would be easier to compromise the OpenStack interface and deploy your own hack system.
It'd probably be easier to pick up the phone and exploit the secretary than it would be to you know, exploit the hypervisor interface itself.
Well, I'm talking about the cloud policy strategy. So, you know, I would go in and deploy a Metasploit, you know, or my own customized Linux hack box as a VM into the, and then I can do whatever I like.
Sure.
Today we go in with the little hack boxes and plug them into the network to give yourself a launch pad for an attack.
Yeah, and what, you know, what one of the things Intel's coming out with is the TXT, Trusted Execution. So you can put a similar to, I think, UEFI boot, where they do signatures on the boot images. It's got some people been out of shape because that means you can't like install Linux on a box anymore. You can only install the appropriate Windows, whatever. But they were talking about using this for hypervisors. Now it's not deployed really. I don't even think it's supported in ESXi yet. Or it is, it's like ESXi 5 or 5.1. But there's a hardware key store on the motherboard with the signature of the boot image. So if someone does root a hypervisor and tries to load it, it won't match the signature and it won't boot on the physical box.
That sounds like a good option.
It is, but it's somewhat restrictive as well, and I think that's kind of what you were alluding to. I mean, I think ultimately it does mean that tampering with the hypervisor is made much more difficult, but because of the limitations and because, you know, in essence, it's basically hardware DRM to some degree. And that said, you know, the complications that it introduces or the limitations, you know, if hypervisors were being exploited regularly, I think organizations would probably be looking towards that, and they'd say, oh, excellent, how and when can we get that plugged in? When can we take advantage of that technology? But, you know, teaching VMware classes, we talk about, you know, the possibility of using trusted execution technology, and people kind of nod and shake their heads and say, yeah, cool, that sounds great. Let me know when it gets here. You know, what are we going to have to change? What are we going to have to buy to make that happen?
Yeah, but
it'll be hard to use and so painful that we won't. Like all good certificate technologies, it'll be crap.
Yeah, but are we in a state of denial? Is that the thing? We're just going to wait for something really bad to happen before we actually start investigating it and trying to make it more usable?
There is a possibility because
certificates. Yes.
Of course.
Well, certificates require automation. Certificates in and of themselves, configuring a PKI at a CLI, which is what I've had for the last 15 years of dicking around with PKI infrastructures, you know, loading certificates at the CLI onto a Cisco router is like, you know, poking my eyes out with a pencil, for God's sake, you know. What you really need is some sort of automated system to say, this is my root certificate, here's my intermediate certificate for all of this stuff, bang, and it rolls out, and then there's an audit process. I want to deviate left a little bit. One of my challenges with cloud automation systems today is the lack of separation of duties. So in particular in VMware, once you're a VMware administrator, you've got God privileges anywhere in the system, and I can't separate duties, which is a PCI requirement, right? The right for need to know, and to deliver need to know separation of duties. So a server administrator should not be able to configure the network, should not be able to configure the security. They should be separated into different teams so that there's no – so it would require significant collusion to create an internal data breach. And VMware does not deliver any of those types of systems. Neither does Xen or Hyper-V. They're too busy getting the core stuff working, and that's a significant challenge to solve today. So I'm still building separated clouds because I don't get the administrative controls in VMware that I need.
Well, you know what makes that worse, Greg, is that even though I agree they don't provide the level of granularity that I would like to see, what's worse is that, you know, in VMware's management consoles, for instance, there still are some slightly better than rudimentary role-based access control mechanisms, but I can count on one finger the number of organizations that I know that are using that effectively. For the most part, you know, everybody is given the administrative privileges, and everybody is expected to only touch the components that they should have access to,
exactly,
rather than taking advantage of the permission controls that do exist, however ineffective or however, again,
but they have to be managed.
Exactly. I mean, this is the point that I have. They're like deer staring in the headlights. I mean, I can't tell you. First of all, the options for all these add-on products in addition to the VMware existing options are overwhelming. And then the complexity is amazing. And it's going to take somebody, you know, with a degree in physics to sit down and actually go through it and say, okay, we want this user to have these rights and this user to have these kinds of rights. I mean, and nobody, organizations are not, they just don't have the cycles to take the time to do this in a lot of cases. You know, they're being thrown into the fire. Okay, here's a UCS. Get it up. You know, it's just –
The funny thing is that in actuality, if the roles exist within, say, Active Directory, if they're effectively defined or they're defined granularly enough within Active Directory, the mappings within VMware aren't actually that cumbersome or that difficult, but – at the same time, that relies on that level of granular role-based access control and the delineation of all these roles within Active Directory, which also doesn't exist.
And how many organizations have done that?
That's right. And that's where the problem lies, is that if they're not doing it with their infrastructure within the organization and all of the users and machines within Active Directory, why and how are they going to do it within VMware, within a single specific product? So I think that's the only time that you really see the use of permissions and RBAC within VMware is when it's done pervasively throughout the organization, throughout Active Directory, and all you're really doing is mapping admin to admin, network to network, VM to VM. But that's very, very rare, and I literally only know of a very small handful of organizations that I've ever seen take effective or make effective use of those the permissions within VMware.
I mean, they're probably the same organizations that have data classification too. It's like the blue fairy came down and, you know, waved her magic wand and made
it
happen. I mean,
that's right.
Well, another thing that I've seen is that some of the vendors make it obnoxiously complex in order to do this separation of roles. You know, they get to you might get to be able to, you might get a product that has a pretty good, like, simple baseline. You have your administrator, godlike access, and then you have your network, and you have your storage, and you have maybe five or six different roles. But to try to do it any more granular than that, you have this huge matrix of potential rights that you can give to, or potential privileges you can give to roles. And it becomes this mess of trying to map this and that and that and this. Kind of an example that I'm familiar with is Cisco UCS. I love Cisco UCS. It's a great blade system. And it's got some basic roles that you can assign users. So a user can be a storage administrator or a network administrator. But to go beyond anything beyond that is just insanely complicated.
Well, Ivan, what are your thoughts? I mean, you've built some – didn't you just build a sizable public cloud?
Yeah, don't ask me for details. I was watching from, you know, from the sidelines.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
I'm sure you are.
Yeah, no. No, I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, if we go to the very beginning where you started with virtual firewalls – and Greg and Taylor more or less answered the question already. So if you're willing to put the outside and inside servers on the same hypervisor, then you may be willing to live with vShield Edge, right? If you think that outside servers and inside servers belong to, I don't know, two clouds or at least two clusters, then you should use physical firewalls like we did.
And what do you think? What did that? And that's what you did. You used physical firewalls, and
we
you
used
separated?
We used PICs.
Yeah.
Well, ASA to be precise. Yeah.
I was going to say PICs.
Well, you know, I'm an old timer. I never mastered the ASA stuff. It's PICs to me.
Well, I mean, just to recap on what a virtual firewall is at this particular point in time, is a virtual firewall come in three broad flavors today. So they are one which comes as a guest in a hypervisor. That is, you deploy a VM, which is a firewall, and your network communication comes up through the vSwitch, and it goes through the firewall and out the other side. That's one form of firewall, and it's a very bad one because the VM runs very slowly. It's got a limited amount of CPU, it's got a limited amount of memory, and the actual time taken to transit a frame.
Sorry, stop you there.
Yeah,
what they can push through now is between 1 gig and I think 4 or 5 gig, depending on how many vCPUs you give to that box.
That's right. 1 gig's enough.
So that's good enough for most people.
Well, it's kind of not because, well, if you're using it as like to emulate a physical firewall, that is, you know, firewall, you've got a physical firewall and you're just going to move it into a virtual function, and then you've got a group of servers on the left and a group of servers on the right, and you're going to route through it. 1 gig firewall is not a bad thing. And up to 4 gigs, as you say, by allocating a bit more memory and a bit more CPU. But what happens if you start to scale on? So let's say you start to grow out your cloud and you now need that to be like a 6 to 10 gig firewall capability. And what happens to it? What I discovered is that those VMs fail disgracefully when you overload them. So when you go over the 1 to 4 gigs, they actually get massively latency driven and eventually just pop a fuse and crash.
Not to mention the fact that performance impact also then affects many, if not all, of the other virtual machines running on that same hypervisor.
Yes, absolutely true. It uses one core, or how many cores you give it.
Sure.
And you're burning up as that firewall gets hotter and hotter, because all the other machines around it are getting hotter, like, then you actually end up with a race condition where everything races for the peak to saturate the peak bandwidth load. So that's one way. The second way is that we now have these firewalls, which are Juniper's VGW and Cisco's virtual ASA, where they actually sit in the hypervisor, in the actual network stack of the hypervisor.
Sorry, the ASA doesn't. The ASA is a VM.
Right.
VSG. Virtual Security Gateway from Cisco, Juniper's VFW, and VMware's vShield are all sitting in what's called the VM Direct Path. And out of those, Cisco's announced that they will ship for Xen and Hyper-V soon.
Yeah, those are called introspection firewalls.
Yeah, and there, Juniper's box is the only one that does everything in kernel. Yep. vShield app is still working through the VM, and VSG from Cisco ships at least the initial packets of every session off to a VM.
Yeah, that was the same thing that I found, too. I'm not sure about Catbird yet, but because as Ivan and I discovered, they have very little technical information on their website.
I think the other problem, though, and I know I'm in a room full of network engineers, so I hope you guys don't throw things at me virtually or physically, but the firewalls, whether we're talking about virtual firewalls, physical firewalls, or introspective firewalls, and don't get me wrong, I think they're all necessary. The problem is we're still, and I hate to drop the old adage of defense in depth, but we're still talking about network-level attacks, and that means these complicated software products, whether they're introspective or virtual machines, they're going to stop a whopping 5 to 7% of the attacks that we're likely to see against this infrastructure. So,
totally true.
Yeah, I mean,
they are only needed because server admins can't configure IP tables correctly.
Oh, see, but they don't want to do it. When I talk to the server guys, they don't want to configure host-based firewalls. They want to use introspection firewalls. They want to use edge firewalls inside the ecosystem of, the virtualization ecosystem. And
yes,
they don't want to have to be bothered with it.
Just passing the buck to someone else.
Sure.
Not my problem.
Okay.
That's right. And I would argue that, the bottom line is you could probably scrap, I still like and rely on firewalls, but you could probably scrap all of the firewalling technology and do effective guest hardening and storage security within these environments and get 80 to 90% better protection from the attacks that are actually likely to occur.
Well, let's face it, that's comedy gold right there. Storage security and application security.
You know what? I in my last environment, I tried to get them to use mod security. I was on the networking team, and I was pushing for mod security deployment or at least some other type of HIDs. And I said that that would be more effective than relying on firewalls. And our own security team fought against that, even testing it.
Okay, so let me tell you a story. We had a company which put mod security on Apache and said we didn't need firewalls. Do you know what happened? The developers knew how to run mod security, but the deployment team did not. And they said, we don't know what mod security is, so they took it off.
I got one better for you. So my last sysadmin job, the last job I had that I was a pure condescending Unix administrator, we had it was my formal title, condescending Unix administrator. We had a development team who had written a special module into Apache. So they wrote their own Apache module. But the problem is they only wrote it for one specific version of Apache. And it wouldn't – I tried to compile it with the most recent version at the time, and it wouldn't – crapped all over the place. So we were stuck on an older version of Apache, and I told them we can't do this. We can't – we can't have this Apache version because no firewall is going to protect against someone who exploits Apache. And sure enough, about 2 months later, all of our Apache systems were zombies for another exploit, in sending out exploits of their own because they had been I don't think the Linux system got rooted. I think Apache – I forget exactly what the exploit was. But anyway, we got infected, and there was nothing we could do because it was revenue-generating systems, and we couldn't bring them up to the most recent version of Apache.
And no firewall would protect you.
No. Once port 80's open, what are you doing? Just bend over and grab your ankles. It's over. Game over. What's depressing to me is the same problems you had. We don't have any improvements here in security. It's like people are still in the same denial. There's still the little hamsters running in the wheel. Is IDS even valuable to put? And then, what IDS is actually hooking into the hypervisor to get, inter-host traffic to examine it? I mean, Taylor?
This is a hard one. I mean, I wouldn't argue against IDS because I still believe it serves a valuable purpose here. But I don't know. It's arguable how much it's actually doing to to protect and prevent attacks in these environments. I mean, again, as a purist, I'm still going to use firewalls. I'm still going to use IDS, and I think they both serve a valuable role. I think that's the interesting thing when we're talking about virtualization security is we've introduced new services. We've changed the paradigm a little bit, but ultimately all the same bits and pieces are here. So,
and all the same limitations that we had before.
Absolutely.
Well, my problem with go ahead, Ivan.
Just because we virtualize something doesn't mean that we can improve it. I mean, there's only so much you can do in the network layer.
Exactly.
There's only so much you can do with a firewall. It doesn't matter whether it's virtual or physical or unicorn-based.
Right, right. Well, at the end of the day, if I can go grab VMDKs right off of your SAN, then why do I care about attacking the application? Why do I care about, trying to perform sophisticated network-level attacks between and amongst virtual machines? I'm just going to copy all of the virtual machines off of the volumes, drop them onto a USB drive, and game over.
Taylor, that's a good point. No, that's a good point.
He's got a point, but let me tell you, when I go and talk to my storage people about security, they just look at me and go, but I'm on a fiber channel network, I'm safe.
Of course.
This is what drives me nuts. So people separate out their clouds, but then they're all going back to the same storage, and there's no separation there, and that's the Achilles heel. I mean, Taylor, is that – so you've done pen testing against virtualization infrastructures, I'm guessing, right?
That's right.
Okay, so where do you most likely find the weakness in most clouds?
Well, I'm going to go back to it, but storage and applications, those are the things that ultimately my guys are going to have the greatest success getting in. And, a lot of times it's low-hanging fruit. As Greg pointed out, the – secure storage is virtually an oxymoron in most organizations. It's not really a thought. And to some degree, I also blame the vendors here. I mean, I guess props to VMware for providing CHAP authentication of our iSCSI, but there's still no encryption supported for iSCSI. So regardless of the storage technology, sure, the Fibre Channel guys are all going to argue that they don't have an issue, that they're secure because they're using Fibre Channel. The iSCSI storage admins are going to say, well, it's on an isolated network. But again, all it takes is getting one machine deployed, with a sniffer installed on the iSCSI network. And admittedly, it's non-trivial, but, we could basically create ghost images of these iSCSI volumes by sniffing the traffic.
Yep. Bring it. Give me more of that because I need to slow down. I mean, I need security. I really need that to be publicized because storage people seriously think that they're invulnerable because their networks aren't on. Like, their stuff is so magically encapsulated, right. in protected by a unicorn field of secret stuff.
Absolutely.
Magic storage stuff that nobody's. There's zero security on storage today.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, and masking and zoning, it's kind of firewalling in a sense, right? I mean, it's not 100%, but it's still necessary, and it's something that we can do, but it's also something that I find that most organizations aren't doing, or else they're not doing very effectively. They're creating huge zones that really kind of obviate any sense of zoning, and they're not using masking much, if at all.
One of the things I think, this might bring up something that we can all do is that is encryption of the volumes themselves, because most of the processors now have ASNI on them, and it'll do AES encryption on the chip itself, so there's very little performance overhead for doing encryption now. So all of our laptops have this now for the most part. Any laptop you bought in the last 4 years will have an ASNI instruction set on the chip, so my laptop is encrypted. Foolproof security? No, but it sure it'll stop 99% of the data thefts that out there because if I copy the volume onto my USB drive and that volume is encrypted, the volume itself is encrypted, the VMDK itself is encrypted and can be easily accessed. Or at least the VMDK can't be accessed that way.
I think it's a great idea, and I totally agree. And I also presume that all of the same organizations that actually know what it means when I send them a PGP signed email will be quick to jump on that bandwagon. But I don't know. I don't find that many organizations really even understand encryption.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than interacting with a security-minded individual at another company and having them reply and say, what is this pgp.sig file? I don't know how to open it.
Yeah. And I blame – now, if you want to make the cloud work for me, then you've got to – then security industry has to find a way to make encryption via certificate work. You've got to come up with better cloud operational tools than you have today. Because today we have all these dicky little CLI programs where if people twitch their fingers at an SSL stack or, you know, all those CA cert and all that sort of stuff, and it's unusable for the vast majority of meatheads that we actually employ, right, in our larger teams. Security needs to do a better job of thinking about things like user interface and approachability and comprehensibility.
Well, that's security vendors. That's the difference there. And I'm just as frustrated. I mean, 802.1x, for example.
Security vendors only poop out what customers put in. Customers aren't. Seriously, right? Customers are vendors, right? So if you put McDonald's food into the vendor's mouth, he's going to poop out a product that looks like a McDonald's turd. And that's exactly what they do. So customers sit and say, I want this tool just like Linux, but I want a vendor to have it. So they poop out a PKI, like Microsoft Certificate Server, which is barely web interface enabled. It's like this mystic thing that hardly even works at all. And everybody goes, wow, that's fantastic. We're done here. It's not. No, it's not. See, certificate management and revocation and all that. So the security industry has seriously let the whole of IT down by not moving away from this uber nerdy roots and developing automation tools and operational capabilities and serviceability around their so-called skill sets.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I'll admit, you can find it on my resume, but I worked for VeriSign 10, 12 years ago, and, you know, they swore PKI was going to change the world. That's just gone terminally wrong.
All right, kick him off the call.
But I will say, and here's the interesting thing, and I find it really sad that this is ignored so blatantly, but I think to a very large degree, as I believe you're implying, Greg, but, you know, properly managed encryption would solve so many of these problems, it's not even funny. I mean, at the end of the day, if I can encrypt my data before I put it in the cloud, whether it's my private cloud, whether it's public cloud, whether it's PaaS, IaaS, or SaaS, the bottom line is if my data is encrypted first, I don't really have to trust you. And I think that's a really, really amazing concept that most people don't get, is that if we can get encryption right, then so much of these other concerns for changing trust models and attack surfaces, they're not completely irrelevant, but they're much, much less relevant.
I mean, but that's the big problem. And it's not just a problem here. It's a problem with everything. It's a problem with wireless. I mean, I'm consistently amazed by how difficult 802.1x is. Why is it that? Why aren't we giving vendors a harder time about this? This should not be this hard. We know that we want it to be encrypted, but it's so mystical to implement. And I think most organizations just give up, like throw up their hands and say, oh, for God's sake, let's just use pre-shared key and be done with it. You know, it's exhausting. That's where I think vendors and customers too, maybe customers need to start yelling louder and giving vendors a hard time about it.
So I think one of the few victories, not a total victory, but one of the few victories that we've had in terms of technology for regular people and for encryption for regular people is with Apple and File Vault 2. So my laptop was super, super easy to enable encryption on it. I just selected encrypt my hard drive, and now my hard drive is encrypted. Now, are there ways to get into that? Are there ways? I think I've seen something where it's possible to get around it or something in Apple, but it's still going to prevent 99% of the 99% of data extraction from my laptop. If I lose my laptop, someone steals my laptop, they're just going to wipe it. They're not going to try to pull the data off. Whereas, you know, a regular laptop without encryption, Microsoft doesn't make it that easy to encrypt your hard drive.
I agree. I think Apple did a really good job with this, and I'm with you. Yes, it is certainly far from perfect, but I think the simplicity of doing full disk encryption with File Vault 2, that's what must exist for this to be possible. Because, Michelle, to your point, I think the problem is customers don't even know that they want encryption. They don't even understand that they need it or want it. They don't understand what it is. They don't see how it will help them. They see it as some weird security foo that all of us weird security people think about and talk about and dream about, and they shouldn't have to worry about this encryption stuff.
Well, and it's not just, in the organizations I've worked in, I'm working on a PCI DSS environment now, but I worked in EDU, and I'm just completely flabbergasted at how people completely are willing to rely on the joke of firewalls, on the fallacy that a firewall is going to protect me. You know, and they poop out firewalls like a rabbit poops out, you know, pellets. And it, everywhere, you know, it's like you have VLAN creep, you have over-segmentation, you have too many firewalls. You know, it's like, oh, and let's throw up another one. And it's just, I don't understand why they're still in such a state of denial and how security vendors can continue to, with a straight face, take people's money over that and not recommend. I mean, don't they understand at some point the emperor is going to be seen to be not have any clothes on? And it's the same with virtualization. I mean, at some point, isn't somebody going to stand up and say, hey, this isn't working?
Yeah. So the analogy that I use here is that firewalls are the equivalent to locking your doors and your windows when you leave your house. So when you leave your house, and then you check the windows are locked, you know, the windows are all closed and the latches are down and your house is locked, right? But there's still nothing to stop anybody from lobbing a brick through your window and climbing in and stealing all your stuff. So once you're through the window, you put all your sensitive stuff into some other thing. So a lot of people will have a safe or a stash somewhere which is not quite so obvious where they can find your things, right? And so to me, firewalls remain the first line of defense against. And if somebody, and in the same way that legally your house is only broken into if your door is, has been forced or there's been a brick thrown through your windows, the same thing applies today that legally if you don't have a firewall, you're liable.
Yeah, and I think that's actually more what it's become. It's become the compliance checkbox and, you know, and IDS, and you'll see that people put IDS in the wrong place, or they're not reading the alerts or the logs. You know, they might have.
No one cares. IDS is still way too hard. The average corporation can't run IDS because it's so complex and requires so much mystical magic. They can't. They deploy them. They work on them for a little while. Every now and then, and for 2 years out of 10, there'll be somebody who knows enough before they move on. IDS is a failed technology as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree.
But
what's worse than that is that even the companies that are providing managed IDS services are doing a really poor job. I won't mention names, but I recently worked with a client who – they received a report from their managed services provider, and the list of rules that were turned on in their managed IDS solution was 2,700 pages long. 2,700 pages of enabled IDS rules, most of which were for operating systems that they don't have running within their organization. And that's an abysmal failure, and that's a horrible, horrible job by the managed security services provider if they're going to allow that to exist.
Yeah, and even worse than that is web application firewalls.
Oh, now, yeah. Everybody turns those on and then they walk away. It's a nightmare,
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some respect, they're perfect because they address the number one, attack vector that we have today. You know, it's either storage or it's the application layer. So SQL injection, cross-site scripting, whatever. And that's where data is getting stolen from. That's how systems are being penetrated these days, or not even penetrated, just data extracted from them. So web application firewalls can take a look at these things and prevent a lot of them, but they're so complicated to deploy primarily because of false positives.
Yeah, I got to tell you, most security people I know won't deploy them because they don't want to deal with them. It's much more comforting for them to, you know, the job security of setting up the firewall, setting up the IDS, which actually isn't doing anything because nobody's reading them, setting up the SIM, and everybody ignores the noise that comes off the SIM. I mean, and it's even more frustrating because to me, when you get into this virtualization environment, the lines get fuzzier and it's easier to make mistakes there. to have permissions that are not correct, for people to, it seems like there's a bigger payoff to the hacker, and that there's more at stake when you have everything in this ecosystem. What's so frightening to me.
I think the WAFs, they're also a misunderstood technology, and what I mean by that is I see a lot of organizations that have custom web apps, and what they do is they put a web application firewall in front, and they turn it on, and all of a sudden they say, oh, crap, my application isn't working. This weird rule that's turned on that says input validation is causing problems. So rather than going and fixing the problem in the application, what do? They disable the rule that's preventing their application from working. Well, so what they're doing is they're setting up these WAFs, and whether or not they're getting false positives, when they do get things being blocked because of a legitimate concern or a legitimate problem with their web app, they don't fix the web app. They just turn off that portion of the web application firewall, and they don't worry about it anymore.
But or Taylor, even worse than that is when they set it up, it works, and it's protecting, and then they change the web app somehow. And that change breaks everything because now something is getting blocked by the web app or web firewall by the WAF, and then they just end up turning the WAF off or turning it into basically useless mode.
Absolutely. To be fair, that's not unique to web application firewalls.
Very true.
That's what scares me about. So you implement something like HITRUST, CatBird, VGW, VSG. So let's say you enable one of these things, these introspective firewalls that have all this fancy, sandboxing and everything else, and then you patch something, and everything breaks, or something breaks and you don't understand why. So what do you think the first thing is that somebody's going to disable?
Sure. Well, and I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, what it is it's basically, hey, I can't get to my application remotely. Please reopen port 23 through the firewall, right? I can't seem to tell that in anymore. What's wrong?
So I do want to come back to virtual firewalls for a minute because they do answer a lot. So to me, it's like a minimum competency. And in the virtual firewall space, there are three, as Ivan was talking about earlier. You were talking about, Ivan, you were saying that VShield is still not in the VM direct path. It's still out of path?
The way I understand it, the packets still go through a VM.
Yeah.
They do, but they work through VMware's API, meaning that the virtual machine is basically considered to be a security VM, meaning that it has direct access to things like, for instance, contents of memory from the perspective of the hypervisor.
So yeah, but
it is a virtual machine, but it has more access than just a virtual machine that sits entirely a layer above the hypervisor. So it's both kind of true and false. They're not running from the hypervisor, but they have access to information via the hypervisor.
Yeah, Taylor, the problem is that the packets that go through the VM NIC have to go through the user land of another VM, and that's the performance bottleneck.
Absolutely. No, I wholeheartedly concur. Mm.
So there's two other solutions there. One is the Cisco Virtual Security Gateway, which operates in the VM direct path. It sits in the Nexus 1000V, which is in the fast path.
But VSG, from my understanding, VSG is comparable to more like VGW. It's more of a zoning and an introspection
No? Michelle, all three of them have the same functionality. All three of them are layer 2 firewalls, so they're bumping the wire. And you put them, functionally speaking, in front of a VM NIC.
Right.
The difference is that VGW does all the filtering in the hypervisor module, in the kernel module. So no user packets go through the user land of a VM, and that's where they get the performance. VShield app, on the other hand, has to push all the VM traffic through another VM, and that's what limits their performance. And VSG is sort of somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, VSG sits in the Nexus 1000V, which sits in the kernel, but it relies on the Nexus supervisor module in an external VM or in an external device somewhere to do the initial forwarding decision.
Yeah.
That's right. It's also interesting that reliance upon that virtual machine or that reliance upon vCenter, it also creates a pretty interesting single point of failure. Admittedly, the 1000V will still function in the absence of that management VM, but control and visibility become pretty limited then.
No, Taylor, it won't. Nexus 1000V will function as a switch, but the firewall functionality of VSG won't function for new sessions. Existing sessions, yes. Once you get the 5-tuple in the kernel, the traffic goes through.
Right, right.
For the new session, the VSG VM must be up and running and reachable. Otherwise, you will not push any traffic through.
Yeah, that's the VGW. That's the they push that a lot when they do their road.
Yeah,
talks.
VGW, because sure. Everything is in the kernel. The VM can crash, and all you will lose is management and logging, but the data plane is intact.
Yeah, that was what I heard too. That was my understanding.
So if you're going to choose something, if you can go with Juniper's – the other interesting thing about Juniper's VGW is that it integrates – has its own security VM in the hypervisor so it can pop out for some advanced inspection. And it also has a security manager, which is a one instance for the entire cluster that you're attempting to run. But the security manager also integrates with the SRX platform. And this is where VGW gets interesting for me, is because I now have an orchestration solution. That is, VGW on the NIC interface of the server actually derives its rules from the configuration in the physical SRX firewall that's upstream. It actually knows about the firewall rules up there, and it'll say, hang on, out of the rule, 2,000 lines in a rule base, picks out the ones that relate to it and then loads them on its NIC. So no matter where it migrates around the cluster, the firewall rules are actually applied to the NIC of the VGW interface. So the virtual NIC or the VM NIC now has the firewall rules applied right at the interface, the NIC interface of the VM. Now that has some really exciting things. One is it integrates with my physical firewalls in terms of whatever, and then two, the operational consideration of loading rules into my physical firewall and then automatically cascading down to my virtual firewall. In other words, I've just got an operational procedure with inside of the sickness that is my existing legacy infrastructure. And I've also got the hope that eventually, once the VGW is in place, I can now move to an orchestrated solution so that as new things are delivered, I actually configure directly into the VGW infrastructure that deploys the rule sets to the VGW at instantiation time.
Well, and I think that's also important because if we're going to call this a cloud solution rather than a virtualization security solution, that orchestration, that automation is necessary. And that's something that absent that, all of the firewalls are really just virtualization security solutions. And they might be part of a cloud security strategy, but that's really all they'll be.
Yeah, we talked about the moral, the ground that the security vendors, like companies like Check Point, still fail to understand the fundamental need of what customers want. Checkpoint still wants to go back to its legacy, its 20-year-old firewall design, with TCL-driven interfaces. And the same for most of the others. Alto, what's that, Palo Alto company? They've only just gotten – they're still so smug about how clever their silicon is that they haven't – and Fortinet, that's the other one. They're all so smug about their hardware solutions they haven't sort of worked out that software no longer works. Sorry, that hardware isn't the answer going forward. And they're all out there pissing into people's pockets and saying how fantastic their products are and this is why you should buy them. But the actual issues underlying here, what you really want in a virtual firewall is something that actually gets all of its firewall rules with a zero amount of work so that it just gets a snoot. So when the developer clicks on this and says, yes, I'm getting a 5-gig hard drive, I'm getting 2 gigs of memory, I'm getting one virtual CPU. Oh, and here's a page of what my firewall rules are. Click, goes down to the VNIC. And I should have a VNIC which is able to perform like the VGW solution, which is like rated it up to 40 gigabits per second. So I never have to be concerned about the performance of the firewall solution. It's all, the limitation is actually still on the underlying architecture.
And that orchestration piece is what apparently is the future. That's what I'm hearing from things like Catbird, for example, that it's, if you vMotion that the security profiles and everything else, that moves with it, that it has that capability. I haven't been able to touch the product yet. We're going to get it in the lab.
But Michelle, every NIC-level firewall has that same functionality.
Apparently, it has some secret sauce that makes it a little more magical. Until I get it in the lab and play with it, I don't know what that is. I mean, but that's the goal, right? I mean, if we're going to go, if we're going to have all this virtualization and everything
you
want to have.
Word for that. That works on VShield app, that works on VGW, that works on VSG. Each one of them supports vMotion.
No, it's not the supporting of vMotion that I'm interested in. It's the supporting of how painless can you get that migration in terms in that flexibility of rules? I mean, what if I change some aspect of, how many templates can I make? How easy can I make this in terms of automation? I guess that's the secret that you want to get. That's the special place you want to get to when you're deploying this stuff. So yes, it could be very cloud-like where everything, a developer just goes and says, okay, here's my bucket of resources. I'm going to create this, this, and this virtual machine. And there's no interaction with the systems group at that point. Or security. I mean, that's the biggest barrier, even with virtualization. We're still using these antiquated techniques. We have machines virtualized in an infrastructure, but we don't have we don't have the automation that supports it and makes it actually easier.
I'm incredibly depressed right now.
Well, me too, because ultimately at the end of the day, once we get around this huge hurdle, then excellent, we've solved the network security problem within our virtual infrastructure. So now all we have to do is secure all of our virtual machines, address the authentication problem, role-based access control, implement encryption to protect our data, and I think we'll be okay.
See? Perfect. Just like that.
Okay, yeah. So we all have our answer.
But I mean,
okay.
Once the firewall problem is solved, we can now go and have the argument with the storage vendors, with the storage people, and say, you guys need to man up. And we can go and talk to the application security people. Because, and the second thing here is that never underestimate the separation of duties. That is, the networking people often act as security's right hand, the iron fist of security. So security sets a policy, and it's the networking people who actually police it with firewalls at the first instance. And to this point in time, server people and VMware people and application devs have a complete disregard for security, and that hasn't changed. They will deliberately make an end run around anything that I do in the firewall. If they get a chance to stop to turn off VGW, they will. And that's my current weakness around VGW, is that the VMware administrator can choose to disable it and not put it on.
Yeah, that's what bothers me. It's like, but what is frustrating to me is instead of what I'm seeing in organizations, is that instead of the security people and networking people and different groups, and even our global security group, our GRC type of staff, instead of coming in to help manage the situation, they're like, that's not my problem. That virtualization stuff, let them do, I'm not touching that. I don't know if it's a sense of fear, if it's a sense of being overwhelmed with other tasks, but they don't understand. If they don't come to the table, if we all don't join in and try to collaborate on this, it's going to be an utter disaster. But they seem to be willing to let that accident happen.
If only storage people didn't smell and be idiots all the time, we'd get along fine. Sorry. Just joking, storage people.
Wait, we didn't make fun of DBAs yet.
There's time.
This time, well, I mean, come on, like, that's gotten Oracle still got, like, zero-day vulnerabilities even after the latest patch set. And my Oracle database is 4 years behind because we're not sure what will happen. Good
product,
because
you've got all the dependencies, all those little pieces and parts that depend on Oracle. I mean, what is it? UltraPoint still doesn't support the most recent release of Oracle, so you update Oracle to make sure you have all the patches and everything else, and then you break all your applications that are dependent on it. It's not necessarily just Oracle's fault. I mean, these other application groups, these vendors, why can't they, get on the same page? And it's like, oh, maybe we should make sure our application works with the latest release of Oracle.
That sounds like Java to me.
DBAs, aren't those the folks who think that all virtual machines should have 8 processors and 16 gigs of RAM?
Oh, my God. You too? Do they do that? They all say, no, I need 5 terabytes of disk space. It's like, really? You're still turning on auto extend? Come on. Really? Taylor, I think you wanted to bring up another point that you thought was critical in this discussion.
Absolutely, and I think that point is really what we would call the malignant operating system within our guests. And I think that's the one thing that we still haven't really managed to address, is that all of these efforts that we're putting into securing the hypervisor, into deploying firewalls, virtual, physical, and otherwise, into providing access control, they're great and they're necessary. But at the end of the day, if our guest operating systems are bloated and improperly secured, then all of the things that we do at the perimeter of the guests really aren't going to have that much impact.
Yeah. Yeah. That's too bad.
Yeah. I think the biggest virus in my network still remains Windows, but then, you know, that's just could be being a bit harsh.
Go ahead, Greg. Come on. I know you want to do it.
No, we're fine. I mean, I've been working on this for a long time, and I'm struggling against the legacy security attitude of, you know, physical firewalls implement zones, but the ultimate expression of zones is a VLAN. And VLANs don't exist inside of a virtualized infrastructure, so you have to do something different. And the single biggest problem I'm struggling with is that security people are stuck in 20-year-old ideas. You know, there was a VLAN vulnerability in, what, 1989, in the early 1990s, and 20 years later they're still going on about it. And I really need the security industry to actually grow up and to learn to think of new ideas and be creative. That is without doubt my single biggest problem. And now, I mean, networking is a little bit at fault here. I mean, the problem with networking is that we actually thought of virtualization in 1996 when we invented VLANs and got them widely deployed in the late 90s. And then again, we reinvented virtualization with MPLS in the early 2000s, 2003 and 2004. In a lot of ways, networking has actually forgotten more about virtualization than most operating systems people know. We know more about securing virtualized infrastructures because we've been deploying them for more than a decade. But server people sit there, you know, VMware's cheering them on and saying, get away from your network, you don't want to deal with the networking people. That's because it's a weakness in their product. Networking in VMware is somewhere around about 2003, 2004 in terms of feature development and feature complexity and product sophistication. It's a weakness in VMware's product, and that's why they hate the network, because it shows them up as in a poor light. And so I need server guys to realize that actually networking people know as much about virtualization in their sphere of excellence as VMware. You know, we've done more about security than they will even know about. And that's really the future of virtualization, is about getting the network and the hypervisors to work together. It's got to come together, and it's got to be orchestrated and operational. It's got to be, and more than just scripts, it's got to be new ways of doing things. And that's the thing that's not happening, is VMware's out there saying, get away from the network, because we don't want you to realize that our product is actually very weak in this area, and it's a weak, so we're going to do overlays, or we're going to do dumb stuff that abstracts away from the network. Instead of working with the networking team, they're actively promoting hostility. And same thing with security. It's not in VMware's interest to engage with the security team. It's not in VMware's commercial interest to engage with security people and say, these are the tools that we need to deploy. So we're stuck with VMware telling all of their VMware administrators in training courses, in real life, saying, don't worry about security. That's you don't need to worry about that. Don't worry about networking. You don't need to worry about that. And storage, we've got that covered. We just present a VAAI or a VASA or an API, and it's all done. You don't need to worry about any of that. Just come and buy our products and get on with it. And there's a lot of people who are drinking that Kool-Aid. That's the problem that we face today with private clouds.
I must have misheard him. I thought he asked for the security industry to get creative.
No, it's not about creating creative. I mean, the most creative that I see, it's like, oh, what can we break next? It's like, guys, come on, solve some problems. I know you're not going to get to dance your little superior jig in front of, you know, the latest HackerCon, but, you know, come on, really. We need to be grown-ups here and build some solutions.
Michelle, the problem is there's nothing we can do. I mean, as long as everyone around us behaves like irresponsible kids, there's nothing we can do. They don't want to own security. They don't want to code the applications correctly. They don't want to harden the operating systems. And they expect us and the security people to solve their problems for them.
I think that's a very, very excellent point. And that's really what it boils down to. If they don't want to be secure, there's not much we can do to secure them.
Exactly.
I think there are people out there. It's just, you know, what I see is, I think a lot of it is a communications issue. A lot of, they just, organizations seem to reinforce silos. They reinforce contention and obstruction. And as long as we're in that mindset and we're not from a position of engagement and collaboration, I mean, we're not going to make progress. But that just seems to be the way of
DevOps?
Doing business. What?
Do I hear DevOps? No, actually, that's the only thing that could potentially work. Because as long as you can code your crap and throw it across the wall and let other people deploy it and not take any responsibility for it, we won't move forward.
Yeah. Well, this seems.
I think you should know I'm feeling very depressed.
Well, I think that might be a good place to stop then.
There's been a lot of sighing on this podcast today.
I know. Because none of us seem to have the answers. We know what the problem is, and we do have answers, but we can't make people do what we want them to. Well, anybody have any parting thoughts before we call it a day?
Don't stop deploying firewalls. We still need some.
And Checkpoint still needs customers.
That's right. Remember, kids, firewalls aren't complicated. They're just routers that don't work.
Okay, on that note... Many thanks to all for listening to this tale, and may the Packet Fairy bring thou jumbo frames, good data center cable management, consistent MTUs, and of course, unicorns. I hope you can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers or join our listeners in IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to readeth blogs by members of the growing Packet Pushers Roundtable. Subscribe to our RSS feeds and donate to the show because Sir Ethan's armor is looking a little rusty and Greg needs a new whoopee cushion. Email your comments or questions about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com or healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia because sometimes they really are out to get you.
Unicorn loves you.